We are up to Perek Bet, Pasuk Chaf Dalid, Chapter 2, Verse 24. Today we really start Kohelet in earnest. Up until now we've essentially dealt with the introduction. Historical background, philosophical background, Shlomo, Beit HaMikdash, Gan Eden, issues, philosophical symbols and images of Kohelet. Today the hard work begins. So everything that we've done up until now has been leading to an effort to read the text of Kohelet with the variables that we can begin to apply chapter by chapter, answering the question, the critical question, which is, who is speaking and to whom? Those are the two questions that are going to stay with us through our study of the text. Who is speaking? And is the primary question, the secondary question, to whom, although that's not necessarily always clear. Perek Bet Pasuk Chaf Dalet 2:24. Ein tov ba'adam שיאכל ושתה והראת נפשו טוב בעמלו. I have to be careful how you translate this verse, because it changes the meaning significantly. There's a word missing. To translate it correctly, you have to translate it as, there is no good other than. Ein tov ela. Right, the ela is missing. But clearly from the parallel verses in this chapter, which there are three, one sees clearly that that is the meaning of the verse. Ein tov ba'adam ela she'achal v'shata v'erat nafsho tov ba'amalo. There is nothing better for man to do than to eat, drink, and enjoy all of the toil in the world. Gam zora iti ani ki miyad ha'elokim hi. This I have seen is from the hand of God. Ki mi yochal u'mi yachush chutz mimeni. Who is going to enjoy and who is going to eat and benefit from this world other than me? Ki la'adam shetov lefanav natan chokhmah v'da'at v'simcha. To the man who is good before him, good before whom? Who's the him? In this verse, who's the pronoun? Tov lefanav, God. Miyad ha'elokim hi. The one who is good before God, God has given him wisdom and understanding and joy, pleasure. Vilachote, in contradistinction to the one who is tov, to the sinner, to the chote, netan inyan le'esof vilichnos. He's made it his lot in life to have to go out and work for a living and to gather and to toil, so that latet livtov lifnei ha'elokim, so that he can give it to the one who is good before God. There are two people in the world, the one who is good and the one who is a sinner. The one who is good gets to enjoy the world. The sinner gets to toil and provide the benefit for the one who is good before God. Gam ze hevel ureut ruach. This too is vanity. Lakozman ve'et l'chol chefetz tachat hashemayim. To everything there is a time, and to everything there is a desire under the heavens. By the time we finish this year tonight, you will, number one, understand how not to sing this song, and number two, you will not want to sing this song. It is not l'kol zman ve'et. There is no such phrase as l'kol zman ve'et. The phrase is l'kol zman ve'et l'chol chefetz tachat hashemayim. To everything there is a time, and there is an appointed time or an et to every matter, to everything under the heavens. Et laledet ve'et lamut et latat ve'et lakor natua. Time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot that which is planted. Et laharog ve et lirpo, et lifrotz ve et lifnot. Time to kill, a time to heal, a time to destroy and a time to build. Et livkot ve et lischok, et tzvod ve et rkod. Time to cry, time to laugh, time to eulogize, a time to dance. Et lashlich avanim, et knos avanim. Time to throw the scatter the stones, a time to gather the stones. Et lachavok ve et lirchok mechabek. Time to hug, time to push away. Et levakesh ve et laved. Time to seek, time to lose. Et lishmor ve et lashlich. Time to protect, time to throw away. Et likrov, et litpor. Time to sew, time to rip. Et lachashot ve'et adaber, time to be silent and a time to speak. Et le'ahov ve'et lisno, et milchama ve'et shalom. A time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, a time for peace. Perhaps one of the most well-known passages in all of Tanakh. Ma yitron ha'oseh ba'asher hu amel. What profit, what benefit does the toiler have in all that he toils? I have seen all that God has given man to vex him with. God has made everything beautiful in its time. גם את העולם נתן בליבה מבלי אשר לא ימצא אדם את המעשה אשר עשה האלוקים מראש ועד סוף. That's a very hard phrase to translate. The simple reason that if I translate, I don't know how many translations we have in the room, but I'll bet you every single one of them says, כי גם את העולם נתן בליבם, God has given the world to them. How does it translate? Gam et ha'olam natan b'libam.
He has set the mystery of the world in their hearts.
The mystery of the world in their hearts. Gam et ha'olam natan b'libam. The enigma, the mystery, is asher lo yimtza adam et ha'maaseh. Man cannot possibly comprehend that which is done, that which God does in the world. Asher asah Elokim mirosh v'ad sof. Man cannot possibly comprehend that which God does ba'olam, in the world. Gam et ha'olam natan b'libam. Correct? Any other translations? Any other translations? No? What's the problem with the translation?
Olam means forever.
Correct. This is only one of two places in the entire Tanakh where the phrase is ha'olam, with a definitive article. Whereas it's always, olam is always a reference to eternity. We once talked about this. Olam Tanakh is a time frame, not a physical place. Olam is a physical place referring to the world is a Mishnaic usage of the term. Problematic translation, how did the word olam enter into the picture here? And without getting into the possibility of dealing with an editing, which I refuse to accept, we need to retranslate the phrase. And so says the Ibn Ezra. You can look up, if you want, you can look up the Ibn Ezra. It's the one, oh my goodness, I forgot to make a source page. Okay. Mickey, I've got a job for you. Since you're the only one who knows how to use the
key.
You have the key. I need 30 copies if you don't mind. If you look at the Ibn Ezra, he writes that the word olam here can't mean world because everywhere in Tanakh, olam is a time frame. So he translates the phrase here. It means one of two things. It either means eternity or comes from the root ha'elem, which means that which is disappear or hidden. So either it means et ha'olam natan b'libam, which is probably where the translation of enigma in the heart comes from. He has put a mystery into the heart. Or it means, as the Ibn Ezra says, God has given, that man perceives himself as if he has an eternity to try to figure out God's ways in the world. Amet ha'olam, for eternity, man perceives himself as having the eternity. Natam b'libam mibli ash, and with all of that time in the world, asher lo yimtza ha'adam et ma'aseh asher asah Elokim. All that time in the world, man perceives, he will never figure out God's ways in the world. They are beyond his comprehension. That's an aside. Continuing. Yadati ki hein tov bam ki im lismoach v'lasot tov b'chayav. I therefore know, I know that there is nothing better for man, nothing more, nothing good other than to rejoice and to benefit from the goodness in the world. Vegam, kol adam shiachal v'shata, if a person is able to eat and to drink, v'ra'atov b'chalamalo, and indeed to see the good of all of his toil, matata lukimi, this is a gift from God. Yedati, ki kol ashiyasah elokim, hu yiyah le'olam, everything that God does will be eternal. Alav en lo sif u'mimenu en ligro, you can't add to it, you can't detract from it. Ve'elokim asah shiru milefanav, and God has done all this so that man shall fear him. Ma she'ya kvahu, v'asher liyot kvahaya, that which was will be, that which will be was. V'alokim yivakesh et nirdaf. V'alokim yivakesh et nirdaf, God will seek that which is pursued. I'm not quite sure what that means. How do they translate? V'alokim yivakesh et nirdaf? How do they translate that phrase? God seeks the pursued. Pasuk Tetzayin. Va'od ra'iti tachat ha-shamash. This too I have seen under the heavens. Leave the pages. We'll get to it eventually. We're nowhere near the pages right now. Od ra'iti tachat ha-shamash. Makom ha-mishpat Shama HaRasha. U'makom HaTzedek Shama HaRasha. In the place of justice, that is where you will find evil. In the place of the righteous, there you will find the wicked. Amarti ani b'libi et ha-tzadik v'et ha-rasha yishpot Elokim. I said in my heart, the righteous and the wicked, God will judge. Ki et lechol chefetz ve'al kol ha'maaseh sham. For there is a time for everything and for every deed there. Amarti ani b'libi al divrat b'nei ha'adam levaram ha'elokim. I said in my heart, on the matter of man created by God, lirot shehem behema hema lehem, that one can see that man is but a beast, an animal. Kimikre bnei adam u'mikre behema u'mikre echad lehem, the end result of the human being and the end result of the animal is the same end for both of them. Kimot ze, kimot ze, the end of one is exactly like the end of the other. Beruach echad lakol, there is but one spirit to all. Umatara adam min habema ayin ki akol havel, man is nothing more than a beast of the field. His advantage of man over beast is nothing, for everything is vanity. If you don't believe me, go to the science center, you'll see it. Hakol holech el makom echad, everything ends up in the same place, meaning the grave. Hakol hayam min afar, kol shav el afar. Everything starts in dust, everything ends in dust. Mi yodea ruach bnei adam olai lamala v'ruach habeima yoredeti lamata la'aretz. Who knows if the man, spirit of man goes up to the heavens, if the spirit of man and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth. Who knows? Do you know? I don't know. V'ra'iti, I have therefore seen, with all that I don't know, I've come to one conclusion. Ki ein tov me'asher yismach ha'adam b'ma'asav, that there is nothing better for man to do than to enjoy his deeds, enjoy the world, enjoy the ride. Ki hu chelko, for that is all that man has. Ki mi v'yenu lirot b'mashiach harav, who is going to bring man to be able to see that which comes after him? That which comes after him, it's irrelevant. The only thing relevant right now is a full belly. Go home. That's it. We're done. All right. Perek Dalet is already a very different tone. Perek Dalet is Reshavti Ani. First of all, I have returned, I've come back, I've moved away from this perspective. Veret kol ha'ashukim ha'shen nasim tachat ha'shemesh. And I saw all of the oppressed, and it talks about the tear of the oppressed, and the praise of the dead over the living, shebech ani et hametim over the minachayim. That's already a very different voice than what we've just heard. So we're going to stop at the end of chapter 3 and assume that chapter 4 begins a different voice. Can talk about the goal of life being to eat, to enjoy the moment, and then say that the dead are better than the living. It doesn't work. Clearly, those cannot be articulated by the same philosophical perspective, and that would be one of the examples of a contradiction. That our resolution to that contradiction is to assume that we're dealing with two different voices. Part of the challenge that we are going to face in studying Qohelet is finding those transitional places. Where does one voice end and the other voice begin, since the text doesn't tell? We have to do it from context and the text itself. So let's start with the basic question. Who's speaking? It's only four possibilities. All right, let's go over them again. Only four possibilities. Possibility number one is the Yirei Elokim. We are going to exclude him from the equation. Why? Doesn't sound like that's who it is, and I'm not prepared to accept the position that the Yirei Elokim would say that the only value in life is to eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die.
And it's between animals and people.
And that the only advantage of animals, that there is no advantage to animals over, of the people over animals, although we say that in at Ne'ilah time, but nonetheless. So who's left? So we have
Epicurus himself.
Epicurus. Ah. The Nehaneh, the Amal, and the Chacha. Those are our four voices. Let's do this by process of elimination, although clearly you are correct. The Chacham. There's no discussion of Chochmah, there's no discussion of philosophy, discussion of wisdom or the value of wisdom. No.
The Amal. Is that what God does good for the wise person?
There's a half a phrase or a half a, that the smart person will eat and drink.
Right. Okay.
Right?
Okay. Not sit and contemplate.
That not sit and contemplate. Exactly, right? The Amal?
No.
Clearly, no. How does he describe the Amal? He makes reference to the Amal, very specific reference to the Amal.
He's serving the wise person.
Right? He's serving the smart guy who's eating all his food. He is called, in the words of this chapter, he is called the sinner, the chote. And the one who gets to eat from the food and from the produce and from the result of all the toil of the amal, he is called the one who is tov lefanav. It's good before God. And that essentially is the recurring theme through this entire chapter, from the very beginning, from chapter 2, 24, Ein tov ba'adam ki im shiyochal v'shata. There's nothing better for man. The ultimate good comes from le'achol shiyochal v'shata, that he should eat and to drink, ve'hera et nafsho tov, to enjoy the world. And that theme you'll find reiterated a number of places. Chapter 3, verse 12 and 13, Yadati ki ein tov bam ki im lismoach v'lasot tov b'chayav. Nothing better than to rejoice and to do that which is good. V'gam kol adam sheyachal v'shata v'rato b'chol amalom atat elokim hi. This ability to eat and drink and enjoy is a gift from God. And that's how the chapter ends. Pasuk chaf bet. V'ra'iti ki ein tov me'asher yismach ha'adam. There's nothing better than to eat and enjoy the world. So this is a recurring theme. It starts, it brackets the entire chapter. It starts in the beginning, chapter 2, verse 24. It goes all the way to the end of chapter 3. Clearly, this is the bracket. Perek Bet, Chof Dalet, through Gimel, Chof Bet, That's the structure of the speech we are addressing, which is that of the hedonist, the pleasure person, the nehene, as we have come to know him and love him. So what is he saying? How do we define the philosophy of the nehene? One of the problems that we have in or challenges that we have with Kohelet is that these speeches are long and they don't necessarily convey a single perspective. There's transitions that are taking place within the perspective. So we have to sort of take it piece by piece. If I would start from the end, the very last verse, 322, Perek Yimochot, Pasachot Bet, if I started from there, what essentially is he saying? Ra'iti ki ein tov ma'asher yismach adam b'ma'asav ki hu chelko ki mi yevienu lirot b'ma'ashiyah acharav. What's he saying?
Be happy for the moment, you don't know what's coming
up. What's he struggling with? What's irking him? What's challenging him?
The afterlife. Death.
So he hasn't gotten to an afterlife yet, but death. But death. He's challenged by the problem of death. He's challenged by the Mikre Echad Lakulam. The ultimate end of all is the same. End of the animal, the end of the human being. Everything is going to end up in the grave. Kimikre Echad Lakol. And therefore, his conclusion, the solution, if you will, his way of conquering or of dealing with death is to say, enjoy the moment. Live for the now. Take what you can out of the world as it is right now, because who knows what's going to be. We don't know what goes on beyond death. Ultimately, death is a blank wall. You can't see what's beyond it. You can't see or perceive what's beyond it. The only real substance is that which you can take right now. Clearly, that is a enormously problematic philosophical worldview for us to relate to theologically. A couple of weeks ago, I gave a drasha about Yitzchak and about Esav and Yaakov, and I applied the phrase nowism to the worldview of Esav. We'll come back to Esav a little bit later, but this is a real expression of nowism. Live for the now. The now is the only reality that makes any difference in the world. A very theologically challenging, problematic philosophy. On the other hand, and this is really our point of departure, if I go back to the beginning of this chapter, forget knowing where it's going to end, let's go back to the beginning, and I ask the question, from the perspective of the text as it's presented, are we dealing with an individual who has a sense of faith in God, reverence for God, acknowledgement and value of God and God's role in the world? From the text. I think the answer is absolutely. Absolutely. And you see it from the very beginning in a profound way. First of all, before you even get into the substance of what he says, notice the change in the form of speech. Chapter 2 was written in first person. Talked about that a couple of weeks ago. This egocentric I that embraced the world and could not see beyond himself. Even his own son, he described as Adam Sheyeh Acharai, the one who will come after me. And there's certainly not a single reference to God in that whole chapter, because there's no room for God when you apply the first person verb 93 times. This chapter, on the other hand, shifts to third person. Vast majority of it is third person, the majority of it. there's a half a reference to I have seen, I concluded, ra'iti, but the subject here, the people who he's talking about, are the tov lefanav, the chote lefanav, the good person, the bad person, the one who will eat, the one who will toil. Everything's now become third person. He's talking about others, not necessarily about himself. That's a major transition. And one of our indicators to a change in speaker is that at least for the first half of the Sefer, each speaker speaks with a different pattern, different form of speech. The Amal, the toiler, the builder, will speak in first person because everything revolves around him. The Nehene, who's benefiting from the world, speaks in third person because there's a certain abstraction. He's not in control. And we'll see a little bit later, I'll tell you already the secret to the Sefer, the Yerei Elokim, what form of speech do you think he speaks in? Second, because he's always giving Musa. Right? The Yerei Elokim is always talking to you, because he's always giving Musa. Very interesting perspective.
But what's the logic of the man that speaks in the third person?
Well, you see it here. It'll become clearer as we go along, but he's benefiting from the world almost as an abstraction, almost as a distance, almost like the recipient. There's no effort of his part, so he's not a player in that regard. Number one. And number two, what other indication is there that we're dealing with a very religious persona, at least from the beginning of this text?
Everything's
from the hand of God. You look at it carefully, you'll see the name, the word Elohim appears in almost every sentence to the first half of this text. Pasuk of Dalid, ki miyad ha'Elohim hi. This ability to eat and drink is a gift from God. Pasuk Chavav, clearly, talks about the sinner and the one who is good, the chote and the tov, lifnei ha'Elohim. Chapter 3, where he starts talking about the song of the seasons, I'll come back to a little bit later. But take a look at verse 11. Pasuk Yud Aleph, et hakol asa yafe be'ito. What does that mean? Et hakol asa yafe be'ito. Who is he talking about? God made a beautiful world, made a perfect world. Everything in its proper place and time. Look at the world that God has made. Man can spend an eternity. He'll never be able to comprehend that which God has done in this world because it's so powerful, it's so profound, it's so beautiful, it's so perfect. Man can't begin to fathom it. Pasuk Yudalad, Yadati ki kol asher ya'aseh ha'elokim hu yeh li'olam. What God does is eternal. You can't add to it, you can't detract from it, you can't change it. God is in control of this world. And all of this God did so that you shall fear Him. So clearly there is a profound sense of faith. God is in control. God is running this world. And therefore your job is to enjoy it. So on the one hand, there is a great deal of Yirat Shamayim, a great deal of faith in God, of fear of heaven, of reverence for heaven. And on the other hand, this chapter concludes with a very distasteful critique of the human being to the point where man is no better than the beast of the field, and you might as well eat and enjoy the ride because you're going to die, which is very shocking. So the question that we have to keep in the back of our mind is what happens between the beginning of this chapter and the end of this chapter? What's transitioned him from one place to the other?
Does his faith wane with the last question for who can enable him to see what will be after him?
I think his faith wanes before that, but we'll come to it. I leave that question open for now. I don't think we're going to have time to address it tonight. But I leave it as one of the questions we have to look at in this chapter is what happened to the Nehene between his opening chapter and his opening volley, if you will, and his return serve. Something happened in the middle. And the question is what? What's at the center of this philosophical view of the Nehaneh? How do you get from Yirat Shamayim to a philosophy that says that your purpose in this world is to eat, drink, and enjoy? What's the core of his philosophical worldview?
Can I ask you something?
You
why
can. Ask anything
do
you like.
Why are you painting it as a mutually exclusive thing? Because it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. And I think if you read it, it's not necessarily mutually exclusive. In other words, you can vex yourself over the complexities of the world and the unfathomable parts of the world and drive yourself to the point where you're trying to gain the knowledge. Or you can say, I'm limited, and I should fear God, and expects me to fear him, yet he also expects me to enjoy myself. And he kind of says that here.
That's fine, and that's not the issue. The issue isn't, that's not the concern. The concern I have is that
one thing, it means I don't think the other.
The concern is the last, the concern isn't that you can't be, you can't fear God and enjoy the world. You can, in limited terms, for now I'll put that in parentheses. My concern is his conclusion. His conclusion is very, is almost anti-God. His conclusion is a very harsh critique of the only reality in this world is to, is you're going to die. So you might as well enjoy the ride. That's a very different perspective than the one who starts and says, you're in God's world. Look at the perfection of this world. Look how beautiful a world God made, and therefore enjoy it. To his conclusion that says, look how terrible this world is. You're going to die. You might as well enjoy it. Two very different perspectives. They ultimately share the notion that our purpose is to enjoy the world. Mm-hmm. But from a very different philosophical perspective. Something happened here, something significant. But what that significant thing is, I reserve judgment on for now. I want to leave it open. Yes?
I'm noticing two things that seem inconsistent with the picture you would have of a hedonist. And one is there's still the idea that there's, you can't always have pleasure. There's time for time for other things. And there's a time to do this and a time not to do it. And the other is there's nothing about how you treat other people.
Well, that question leave. Hold. Okay? That last question, hold. Because I think that you've hit the issue. But I'm not there yet. How you treat other people is going to, I think, become the central pivot around which the Nene is going to run himself in circles. Before you get there, however, your first question, which is there's room for everything, brings us to what I believe is the centerpiece of the Nene's philosophy. The centerpiece of the Nene's philosophy is articulated in this chapter in this Shir Ha'itim, as it's called, this song of the seasons. So it's really that song that I want to try to understand. It'll begin to tell us what the Nehneh is all about, at least from his starting point. Why do I call it a song? Why do I call it a shir? Not because we sing it. L'kol zman ve'etem butcher it. Right? Not because we sing it in... Oh, because it's written in Shira. Because it's written in Shira. Simple answer is, in Tanakh, it's written in Shira. Simple. Tanakh has two forms for Shira. Anytime you have one of these two forms printed in the Tanakh in this way, you know you're dealing with song. One is two columns, like Shirat Ta'azinu, Shir Ha'itim, the song of the 31 kings in Sefer Yehoshua. Anytime you see two columns and words on one column, words on the other, and a space in between, you're dealing with Shira. And the other is the way Shirat Hayam is written, which is like this. And you see them will print it that way. Both of these formats are Shira. They mean different things. And the significance and the difference between them is not my topic for now, but clearly this is Shir. This is song. And it's meant to be sung in a certain sense. It's meant to be poetic. It's meant to convey. Every song has a conclusion. So what you really want to identify here is what is his conclusion. Let's look at the song again, beginning of chapter 3. Lakol's man ve'et l'chochefet tachat ha'shamayim. Everything has a place, everything has a time under the a season or a time under the heavens. I'm not going to reread the Shira, et aledet, et lamut, et latat, et lakonatu. It goes through all of the different experiences of life. To kill, to heal, to destroy, to build, to be silent. They're all, by the way, expressions of human effort, just as an aside. What's his conclusion? What is the message of this shir? What is it designed to convey in one phrase? Sum up this shira in its basic core message. You have to look at the text to do it. No. That's his introduction. That's where he starts from. That's not his conclusion. You are not in control. How do you know?
It's all going to happen to you no matter what you do.
It's all going to happen no matter what you do. How do you know that's his conclusion? Thank you. Ma yitron la'ama ha'oseh ba'asher hu amel. What benefit does the worker have in his toil? If you were to write it out, this is the way it would look. L'chol zman ve'et l'chol chefetz. To everything there is a time, and to everything there is a season. Eight. Therefore,
ma yitron ha'oseh ba'asher hu amel.
What advantage, what benefit, what purpose does the worker have in all that he does? Nothing. You can do and do and do and achieve nothing. Why? Why? Ra'iti et ha'inyan asher natan Elokim livnei ha'adam. I saw the matter that God has done. Et ha'kol asa yafer. God has done everything in its proper time. Who's in control in this world? God. It's a beautiful world to be in. A world in which God is in total and complete control.
So he says, what's the purpose of working if everything has been done and given in its time?
It's not even what the purpose is. It's almost anti-religious. God is running this world. Don't, if the toiler, the builder, the creator, one who wants to put his mark in the world, he thinks he's in control of this world. The Nehenes says to him, you're not in control. You were never meant to be in control. God's running this world. Everything happens for a reason. Everything happens because God dictates the time frame for it to happen and how it's going to happen. And the crying and the healing and the hurting and the building and the destroying and the loving and the hating and the wars. Everything is predetermined, predirected by God. It's a philosophy of ultimate fatalism.
Isn't there another dimension to this, though, that he's dealing only with what he can see? Explanation where we would talk about Allah or something that he's saying, this is what I can see, and I see justice. There is some justice, but it's all in this world. There's no scheme.
He is not looking at Allah Abba at all yet. Zero.
It's only what he can see.
100%, because that's what Kohelet's all about. He's judging the world on the basis of his philosophy of what he's perceived and what he's concluded. You and I may come to a different conclusion. That's not my issue. My issue, and I will not ask the question, do you agree or don't agree with Kohelet in any particular chapter? I don't need to. I got enough voices in the text to criticize Kohelet. You don't have to worry about it.
A philosophy that says I'm going to use as my basis only what I can.
Correct. That is the foundation of all of wisdom in Sefer Kohelet. I look at the world on the basis of what I see and what I've experienced and draw my own conclusions.
So he's saying, after death, we don't know what's there.
Correct. He's saying, essentially, that the world itself was created for God to essentially set the table. And if God is in control, complete control, total control, what are we doing here? What's his answer? Again, we're focusing primarily on the first half of this text. What is his answer? What is my role in this world if God is in complete and total control? If l'chozman, v'et l'chachefetz, everything's dictated by God. Et for everything. Everything God does is beautiful, perfect. Man can spend an eternity and never unravel the mystery of what God does because God's too perfect for that. What's my purpose then? Enjoy it. Benefit from it. But not in the hedonistic sense of the term. Part of the problem is that I biased our conversation by talking about hedonism, which is a very pejorative term. Talked about the nehene, which is a very pejorative term. He doesn't. He talks about... The text talks doesn't use the term nehene. The text uses the term tov and simcha and... Le'echol v'nishtot. Is achila and shtiya necessarily bad? Tell me something. Adam HaRishon in Gan Eden, was he allowed to eat? Was that bad? Au contraire. Could eat from Gan Eden. He could eat from the works of the Ribbono Shel Olam. We talk about the ability to benefit from this world is essentially to say, in the words of Kohelet, God has put us in this world so that he can... feed us, bestow goodness upon us. Let me take it one step further. It reminds us, in a certain sense, of a medrash, and this medrash I've given you on the text because I wanted you to see it. It comes from a number of places, but the simplest is the Alkut Shimoni, just the source number one. The question that the Medrash asks, you know, I'm not going to go through the whole analysis of creation, but you are certainly familiar with the fact that the story of creation appears twice. Soloveitchik built his whole essay on Lonely Man of Faith around that description of the two paradigms in the creation of the human being. The first chapter describes a process in which the world is all created and then the human being is placed in this world. Man is created last. The second chapter reverses it. The second chapter describes a situation where there is no vegetation and no growth and nothing in this world, ki adam ayin la'avodat adama, because man is not yet created. And so you need to put man in this world so that he can work the fields, and from the fields will come vegetation. They're two very different descriptions of the creation. The Medrash asks the question in the first chapter, why was man created last? And the Medrash answers, "Kidei sheyikanes l'seuda," so that man should be able to come into the meal already ready. Miyad l'seuda miyad. Mashal melech basar v'adam. This can be compared to an earthly king. Shebana platrin built himself a palace. V'itkin seuda, and then he set the table, and he prepared a feast of feasts. V'achakach ichnis orchim. Then he went and he invited all his guests. There'd be no point inviting your guests and then starting to cook the meal. You cook the meal first, and then you invite your guests to dinner. What's the meal? The world as it was given to us. God created it, and he put us into this world last for us to be God's guests. And to benefit, to enjoy the world. Now there is a certain opening chapter of Misilat Yesharim, opening chapter, Mesilat Yesharim, essentially describes a similar kind of notion, which says that the entire purpose of the creation of the human being is so that we can benefit from God's goodness, so that we can be the recipients of God's goodness. Only difference is that Mesilat Yesharim, because it's a rabbinic work, shifts the focus of the place of that benefit to the world of Olam Haba. And Tanakh will focus the world of that, the arena of that benefit, in Olam Hazeh. But the concept essentially is the same. The purpose of the human being is to benefit from God's goodness. It's to be the recipients, is to be God's guests in this world. And if God is in control, and God is the balabait, and God is the master, then our role is to enjoy the benefit of that which God has created. Every time we make a bracha, we bite into an apple, we make a bracha, bar pre'eitz, we are saying we are enjoying the world that God has given us. Essentially, God means creator. God has given us the world, and our job is to benefit from the world. It's a simple equation. On a theological level, that's the equation. God made the world, and he put us in this world to be his guests.
The subtlety of the shir seems to be uplifting because of the rhythm. And the rhythm gives voice to God's control.
I know what you're saying. It is uplifting. It's meant to be uplifting. The first half of this chapter is meant to be a positive declaration of faith, a sense that you literally live as a guest in God's garden. Remember the Gan Eden theme? Mm-hmm. You live in Gan Eden and you are benefiting from the world that God has created. What could be better than that? Which biblical persona, now we're going to bring this down into the concrete. Which biblical persona best exemplifies the philosophy of the Ne'eneh as we have just articulated it? Okay, I'll narrow the scope. Sefer Breshit. Adam? Not in the least. Adam is the exact opposite. If there's any personality that Adam reminds me of, it's the Amal. Because the Amal, in contradistinction to the Ne'eneh, the Amal is driven by the desire to control this world. And Adam, who reaches out and takes of the Eitz Hadaat in Gan Eden, is essentially the Amal. Who has said, I want this world, and I want to control it, and I want to put my imprint on it, and therefore I will dethrone God if necessary to take that role. The story of Adam in Perek Bet is the story of the Amal. If the story of Perek Aleph, of man who is put into this world to be the recipient of God's goodness, is the story of the Ne'eneh. That's essentially the difference between Perek Aleph and Perek Bet. You see the distinction between the Amal and the Ne'eneh in this regard. But which biblical persona best exemplifies the Ne'eneh, the one who is driven by the benefit of eating and drinking and enjoying the world that God has put him in? Say that again? Esav. Interesting. I would say Esav partially. I think you're right about Esav. Esav is a? He's a hunter. He's a man of the field. Esav certainly wants to eat and enjoy the world in which he was placed. However, I'm not convinced that he yet completely identifies with the Ne'eneh, because the Ne'eneh is a very theological position. It's full of Yirat Shemayim. It's full of fear and reverence for heaven. I'm not sure that I can yet put Esav into that category, although he does share the Ne'eneh philosophy. But you're close.
Lot? Well, he wants to enjoy things. You know, he goes to a good place. There's lots of nice things there.
No, I'm getting colder. We're getting colder. You were warmer before. You were much warmer before. Yitzchak. The description here is a profound description of Yitzchak. How? It's very simple. You know, it's interesting. Esav, we sometimes people think we give Esav a hard rap. Esav is one of those personalities that the Torah describes him as a Rasha, that we describe him as a Rasha Marusha, and he somehow in today's modern world evokes the sympathies of Parshanut. Esav is a Rasha Marusha, it's no question. Where do you see it, though? Where do you really sense Esav's cruelty, his evil, his insensitivity? Where do you what is the first thing that the Torah tells us about Esav that we recoil from? When he sells his birthright
to eat the soup.
And the phrase there is very interesting. Vayochal, vayesht, vayakum, vayelech, vayivez Esav et ha-bochorah. Ate and he drank and he got up and he walked out and he despised the birthright. He had his bowl of soup and that was all he needed. That's the nehene. That's umatar adam min ha-beima ayin. Nothing more than beast. So I would say Esav is the personality that we can best identify at the end of this chapter. But before we get to the end of this chapter, we have to get to the beginning of this chapter. We have to get to Yitzchak. Who did Esav learn to eat and drink from? Who did he see as a role model to see that the substantive centerpiece of all of human effort and experience is to eat, drink, and enjoy the world? His father. He learned it from his father. When his father wants to give him a blessing, what does he do? He says, go bring me some venison, prepare me a good meal, then I can give you a brach. Tell me everything we know about Yitzchak, post the Akedah. Tell me everything we know about Yitzchak, every story we know. Digs wells so that he can have something to drink. Good. Plants fields that are very productive and gets very wealthy. And he has a lot to eat. And then? What else do we know about him? Right? Enjoys good meals?
Well, it doesn't exactly have a great time with Avimelech, right? They're not exactly the best of friends all the time.
Avimelech is the story of his well-builder. Right? Yitzchak is essentially a personality who is identified here on two levels. That which identifies the hallmark of the Nehaneh isn't the eating and drinking. The eating and drinking is the symptom. The philosophical worldview of the Nehaneh is not that you eat and drink. That's the conclusion. The philosophical worldview of the Nehaneh is that you are not in control. That God
went to the fields and dug the wells.
Even that's not, he's not in control. Everything happens to Yitzchak. Yitzchak's never in the driver's seat in his life. That's part of the whole understanding of Yitzchak, is that he's never in the driver's seat. He's not an Avraham. Avraham's in the driver's seat. He only dug the wells that his father dug. Avraham's in the driver's seat. Yitzchak, everything happens to him. From the Akedah, he has no voice whatsoever. To the brachas of the Yitzchak and Esav, where he has no voice whatsoever. He is the ultimate recipient of everybody else's agenda. He has no agenda of his own. He expresses in his life the total devotion that ultimately God is in complete control. That's what makes Yitzchak Yitzchak. This complete and total acceptance that God is running this world. In a positive sense. In the positive of it. The symptom is that he's so engrossed and so engaged in this sense of God is running this world and he is the recipient of God's goodness in this world that to him, every time he takes a piece of food, He feels, he lives, he literally experiences the sense that he is in Gan Eden. What was the mandate to the human being in Gan Eden? What did God command Adam HaRishon in chapter 1 of Gan Eden? Not chapter 2. In chapter 1. In chapter 2, man is told that he's put into the garden for the purpose of Le'ovda u'le'shomra. Guard it, work it, do it, mandate it, take charge over it. The Rav Soloveitchik's whole essay about chapter 1 and chapter 2, first man, second man, is to draw the distinction between fundamental different philosophy of the role of man in the relationship with God. Chapter 2 is all about take control and responsibility for this world, and then he oversteps the bounds and he eats of the Eitz HaDaat. Chapter 1? By the way, there's no command in chapter 1 not to eat of the Eitz HaDaat. Chapter 1, man is placed into Gan Eden and told, Pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply. Umilu et ha'aretz v'kiv shuha, go conquer, go multiply in the world. And then God says, Hinei natati lechem et kol esav zorea zera, I've given you all of the seeds, all of the trees. Ve'et kol ha'et ha'shebo priya et zorea zera lachem yeh le'ochla. Eat of the fruits of the trees. There's no Eitz HaDaat and there's no Eitz HaChayim. Man is put into the garden with a single mandate to recognize that God is in control and therefore you can benefit from the whole world. That's Yitzchak. Yitzchak lives that identity. In contradistinction to Abraham, who was building mizbeachs and running around the world, Yitzchak builds no mizbeachs and he never calls out to Hashem Hashem. The only thing he ever builds is his father's wells. Everything happens to him. He's the ultimate passive personality, but not because he has no personality, because he's in total devotion to the notion that God is in control. Now go one step further. Every time he wants to sit down and give a bracha, he insists he has to have a good meal. And Esav learned that trait. That what matters to my father is a good meal. So is it any surprise that Esav is a hunter? Is it any surprise that Yitzchak finds a common soulmate in Esav? But there's a fundamental difference between Yitzchak and Esav. They tell the story about the guy who used to wake up every day at 5 o'clock in the morning and drink 4 shots of vodka. Before the day starts, the man was drunk. And they asked him why. And he said, well, that's what my father did. Every day, 5 o'clock in the morning, he had 4 shots of vodka. His father used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, go out into the cold forests, go and do his tefillah and his shachris and his yisbaydidus and all of the other stuff, go collect the wood for the fire, go chop whatever wood he had. He'd come back 5 o'clock in the morning, frozen to the bone, drank 4 cups of vodka in order to warm himself up, and the son woke up just at 5 o'clock. And he saw his father begins the day with 4 cups of vodka. Esav lived his whole life watching his father eat 3 good, hearty meals a day and benching, and that was the totality of his father's religious experience. So I can do that, that's easy. But he missed the point. Because Yitzchak literally lived his life, as Kohelet says at the end, Umatar hadam min ha-behema ayin, ki ha-kol hava. Man is no better than a beast of the field. Yitzchak lived his whole life like a beast of the field. Yitzchak. Why? Where? When did that happen? What transformed Yitzchak into a behemoth? The Akedah. Yitzchak walks into the Akedah, human being, he walks off the Akedah in a sense, in a positive sense, recognizing that he is not in control of this world. He has as much control in this world as an animal in the field does. Everything's dictated to him by God, and he will live the rest of his life in the shadow of the Akedah. Letov, I don't say it negatively. He literally lives in the Beis HaMikdash. He lives on the Akedah. So when he asks for a plate of food, to him he's eating from Gan Eden. Esav was born after the Akedah. Esav never saw the Akedah. So whereas Yitzchak and Esav may share the common theme of the symptom, at the core, Yitzchak is a deeply and profoundly religious personality who is eating every meal out of the literally out of the Garden of Eden, and Esav is a glutton and a hunter.
Maybe a father has a responsibility to pass on to his children what this thing is really all about.
That's a hard issue to address, to apply, I would say, almost modern sentiments of parenthood into the arena of Tanakh. Sefer Bereshit never looked at it from that perspective. That's not the issue. My issue isn't how Esav became an Esav. My issue is to understand where Yitzchak starts from. I'll go one step further. To be a Yitzchak, you have to do two things. To be a Yitzchak, you have to do two things. You have to live with the sense that you are God's guest in this world. To be God's guest means, on the one hand, that whatever God gives you, you're going to enjoy. If God gives you good food, you're going to enjoy that. If God gives you wealth, you're going to enjoy that. But you're going to enjoy it because it's given to you by the Ribbono Shel Olam. You're not in control of this world. God is in control of this world. Total faith and devotion to that idea. The corollary of that is that if there are events that happen to you in your life that are harsh, that are cruel, that are painful, what is your response going to be? The total acceptance of the din. Because you are God's guest in this world. You can't have it both ways. You can't take the philosophy that I'm going to eat and enjoy every possible benefit of this world because God is in control, but the moment something goes wrong, God, how dare you? If you're going to live the philosophy of the oreach, of the guest that came into this world, into Gan Eden last, as the Medrash says, it's got to be consistent through to the end. L'tov l'ra. And what defined Yitzchak was not only that sense that he lived with the understanding that God is in total control of the world, but what defined Yitzchak was when something went wrong, he was completely and totally devoted to whatever God did in this world. When he stood on, when he lay on the Akedah, on the Mizbeach, facing up, he said, "Akol asa yefe b'ito." God runs this world. And when Yaakov disguises himself as Esav and comes in and steals Esav's bracha, and in so doing completely upturns Yitzchak's entire worldview of his children, of who they are and of what they are, and his entire parenting experience has just gone up in smoke, his response is, Kam Baruch Yihyeh. He came, he took, he's blessed. Why? Because I call it a yefebito. What would have happened if at that moment that Yitzchak recognized that Yaakov took the bracha, ba'achicha b'mirma, if at that moment, what would have happened if Yitzchak at that moment would have said, how dare he? Then Yitzchak would have become he would have become whom? He would have become Esav. Because that's exactly what Esav was. Esav was prepared to take and take and take and take, but the moment something went wrong, I'm going to kill my brother. I'm going to kill your brother. You're supposed to live the philosophy of, if you want to follow your father's footsteps and enjoy this world as a guest of God, you're supposed to live the philosophy of total acceptance of Kabbalat HaDin. You can't take half the picture. You can't take the simcha and the achila and the shtiyah and the hana'ah and not accept the principle of Kabbalat HaDin, of acceptance of the judgment. Rosh Hashanah, we invoke Yitzchak's Akedah in the bracha of Zichronos. Correct. Why? Because the bracha of Zichronos is all about acceptance of the din, of judgment. The Zichronot is all about mishpat, it's all about judgment, it's all about acceptance of the judgment. And in that context, we say, V'akedat Yitzchak lebanim tizkor, remember Akedat Yitzchak, which is the ultimate expression of the total and complete acceptance of the judgment by God. But you can't take one without the other. You can't be a Yitzchak and try to benefit from the world and try to live the philosophy that says, God put me in this world to eat, drink, and be merry, because the Greek philosophy, or the philosophy that Yeshayahu identifies of achol b'shatoki machai namut, eat, drink, because tomorrow we die, is how the chapter ends. Eat and drink, because tomorrow you die. But that's not how it begins. How it begins is, eat and drink because God put you into this world. Because God's in control. Because on the contrary, God did everything in its proper time. God is in control of this world. We benefit from God. So he starts as a Yitzchak. And the chapter ends as an Esau. So the question that I asked at the beginning of this year is how we got from the first half to the second half. How did we transition from a Yitzchak into an Esau? Same personality. How did we transform from a Yitzchak into an Esau? That's a subject that I could do in 10 minutes, but I don't think I would do it justice. So I'm going to suggest, if there are any questions, let me address any unfinished issues or questions that we've had here, and then I think I'm going to leave that issue until next week.
A question about the Shira, are those then things that God makes happen at different times? Is that...
So that's...
Maybe I don't understand all the meaning, but you don't have to go through them
That is essentially the point.
That time to love and the time to hate?
Everything is determined by God.
When you should love and when you should hate?
When you should love, when you should hate, when you should kill, when you should make war, when everything.
When you should make peace?
Everything.
Well, God doesn't make war and peace. I mean...
If you take the philosophy to its logical conclusion, remember, the point of each one of these perspectives in Kohelet is that they are extremes of a particular perspective. Nobody lives in the extremes. At least we hope not. The concept is that we all have a piece, we balance all of the different personalities. But from a Kohelet perspective, take each personality, define the criteria that make up the philosophical worldview, and work them through to the logical conclusion. Ultimately, this is a classic example of determinism. God is in complete control. Literally complete control, which includes all the experiences of human endeavor. That's exactly what I pointed out, that every one of those examples, every one of them, he doesn't talk about nature. He doesn't talk about trees growing, and he talks about crying and laughing and eulogizing and dancing and building and destroying and tearing and positive and negative. Every one of them is an expression of human endeavor. And it's in that domain that the Nehenez says, ultimately, the philosophy of the Nehenez is defined by a sense that I am not in control in this world. God is. Now take it to its nth conclusion. You understand where it's going to go? It's going to go to the point where I can pick up a gun and shoot you and say, it wasn't my fault, God wanted it to happen.
Isn't there
that's exactly where it's going to end up. And that's what, that's our shift.
So there's no human responsibility for anything. That
right.
is what you do yourself.
Right. That's ultimately where this is going to go. Not here, not yet in this chapter. In this chapter, he's still going to talk about human responsibility. But where it will end up in later chapters is exactly this issue. Because if you take the Nehenet to its logical conclusion, it removes from the human being all accountability and responsibility for actions. You become the... It denies essentially the concept of Bechira Chavshis. You have to balance it with something. The Nehenet is unbalanced. It's a total devotion to one picture. The Amal is the complete opposite. Man is in complete control. There's no room for God. That's the debate between the Nehenet and the Amal. Who's running this world? The Chacham will enter into the fray, but you understand that ultimately the Yirei Elokim is going to have to balance those two.
In the middle, it clearly brings up issues of people who sin. Or even at the beginning, there's some notion of moral
right. choice. That's going to be the logical inconsistency that the other ones are going to trap him in. Right? The logical loophole that the Nehenet will ultimately fall into is the Nehenet will address the issue of divine justice or divine judgment, and then we'll ask the question, judgment over what? How can you be held accountable and ultimately if you're not in control? He even says it here. Take a look in Pasuk Tetvav. Pasuk Yud Zayin, I should say, 17. Amarti ani b'libi et tzadik v'tarsha yishpot elokim. As for justice and judgment, the wicked and the righteous, God's domain. God will judge. But then we have to ask the question: God is judging on what basis? There has to be accountability for God to be able to judge. So that's the logical piece that the personalities of Kohelet and the voices will dance around that issue.
And what is control refer to? Here it's control over
everything.
The world or everything as opposed to self-control making choices.
Here we're talking about the notion of who's running the world. And man is completely subservient, completely recipient, completely not in control. Ultimately, God is in the driver's seat, even of human behavior. Because I have to take it to its extreme logical conclusion. Any other questions? Okay, next week, Bezrat Hashem, we reverse course from Yitzchak to Esau.